It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike stages a question and answer party. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in defense stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 defense bond, plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now, Oedipus Lucky Strike, as I present our Master of Ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please goes on as usual in its unpremeditated and unrehearsed path. Tonight, John Kieran and Franklin P. Adams are with us, and as our special guests, Dean Taylor, composer and commentator, and Alexander Wolcott, author, raconteur, and critic. Now, we're going to start with a question from John Jennings of New York. What event traditionally occurs at this hour? For example, if I said 11 a.m. once a year, well, what event would that bring to mind, Mr. Adams?
Armistice Day.
That's quite right. That, however, is just an example, Mr. Adams. You don't get any credit for that whatsoever. What event occurs at 7 a.m. Tuesday, traditionally? 7 a.m. Tuesday. Now, this might be once a year, perhaps.
I'm not up then.
Oh, that occurs before you get up then, Mr. Taylor. It's a pre-Taylor event. Mr. Kieran?
The opening of the polls on Election Day?
That's quite right. Yes, the opening of the polls on Election Day. I wonder how many of our listeners thought of it.
Following Tuesday. Next Tuesday.
No, a Tuesday. Do you have to say following Tuesday?
No.
How about 10 p.m. Friday?
Any Friday.
10 p.m. some Fridays. This isn't necessarily once a year. Mr. Kieran.
Heavyweight championship fights begin.
That's right. And they're usually broadcast at that hour over the radio.
And I take the 10 o'clock train home.
You take the 10 o'clock train home, yeah. How is that 10 o'clock train, by the way, Mr. Adam?
Very good.
Very good. Still getting at 11:23, they say. How about 12 noon Saturday? What would that mean to any of you? Mr. Kieran?
The whistle blows.
Yes, though sometimes at 1. Isn't that true?
That's where I worked.
No, I think there'd be another answer to that. Banks close at 12 noon on Saturday. You know what a bank is, Mr. Adams? You have any dealings at all with banks these days?
A wild time grows.
That's the one. Yes, that's one of the wild times at which they close at 12 noon. How about 2 a.m. Sunday? 2 a.m. Sunday. Mr. Taylor.
Oh, daylight saving goes into effect.
Yes, and it will go into effect very shortly for the entire country.
Yeah.
Well, we've got about three quarters.
That will be 2 a.m. Monday this time.
That will be 2 a.m. Monday? Why
won't it be Monday? It's on a Monday this time.
They change
the night.
That's so? Well, I'm very glad to get that announcement made clear to all our listeners. Now, how about this one from E.G. Davison of Belmont, Massachusetts? Again, get 3 out of 4. It's about dinner parties that occurred in plays that you may have seen or in movies that you may have seen. At what dinner party did the guests appear on the wrong night? The guests appeared on the wrong night. Mr. Adams.
I think that was an English play, The Man from Blankley's.
Now, there you have me. I never saw it. Does anyone know The Man from Blankley's, Mr. Wolcott?
I've forgotten it, no.
I wouldn't know. You may be quite right, Mr. Adams. The one I was thinking of was You Can't Take It With You, where the Kirbys, you remember the rich and respectable Kirbys, appear at the house of the humble but crazy. Why, but humble and crazy sycamores.
I thought any night would be wrong there.
That's right, Mr. Wolcott. It might very well be. Might be wrong, and I think we'll have to count your answer wrong, Mr. Adams, until we can look it up in the library. Now, how about this one? At what dinner party did the host refuse to sit down? Mr. Kieran.
That was Macbeth, who refused to sit down because there was a ghost sitting in his chair.
That is right, yes. At what dinner party did the guests of honor fail to appear? Mr. Wolcott.
Dinner at 8.
A dinner at 8, yes. A party given for the Fern Cliffs, it tells me.
Well, they called them wretched little cockneys when they didn't come.
And at what dinner party were the guests asked to decide the fate of two men?
The guests were asked to decide between two men. Oh. Well, it was recently made into a movie. Does that give you any hint at all? It's a play made into a movie? I think it was. Or at least not into a movie, but recently given here, recently revived here. The Doctor's Dilemma. Do you remember? Any of you remember the Doctor, Mr. Wilcott? Remember that?
Yes, of course, that's the one.
Yes, yes, that is the one. They said.
Which the doctor had skill to save one patient, and which did he save?
Yeah, which did he save, by the way?
Well, he voted to save the country practitioner instead of the artist.
Righto. Yeah. And
Because he was in love with the artist's wife.
Yes, for the wrong reason. I think maybe got two wrong on that, and that will send a $50 defense bond to Mr. Davis. How about this one from Philip S. Waters of White Plains, New York? Get 2 out of 3. Now, this is a very tricky one, I think. I'm going to ask you to give me the well-known poem whose opening lines begin with these words. Now, I'll give you just the first words of the first 4 lines. The first line begins with you, the second with and your, the third with and yet you, and the fourth with do you. What poem is it?
You, and your, and yet you, do you. Sounds abusive.
Matter of fact, it's slightly abusive. Slightly abusive, Mr. Taylor. Very slightly. Mr. Curran?
It sounds as though it came from Alice in Wonderland.
You're right, Mr. Curran. How do you know that?
Our old father, William.
Yes.
That's the one. Yes. Your old father, William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white, and yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think that your age it is right? Now, that's a very tricky question. Here's another one. A similar problem. The first words of the 4 lines are should and should and. Mr. Wilcott.
Should a body kiss a body coming to the rod?
No. You've got the first line. Coming would be the beginning of the second line.
All right. That was very good.
Should all acquaintance be forgot?
Yes. Can you continue with it?
And never brought to mind.
Yes. How does it go on? This will slay you, Mr. Adams.
Should old acquaintance be forgot?
Yeah,
and the days of Auld Lang Syne.
And Auld Lang Syne. Yes, that's right. Auld Lang Syne, Burns' Auld Lang Syne.
Now, how about the right country?
Let's see if we can do better on this one. Mine, he, his. Mine, he, his. Mr. Wilcott?
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes, that's right. He is trampling out
the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Yes. He loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes, and if we had a half hour at our disposal, Mr. Wilcott, I'd love to have you explain to us just how it happened to be written.
Yes.
That gives us 2 out of 3.
I don't mean for the battle.
He did a broadcast on that once, too.
Once.
How about this? This comes from Catherine Cashman of Milton, Massachusetts. Again, get 2 out of 3. It's about banks. What characters, whether of fact or fiction, are associated with these banks? The first bank is the Northfield Bank. The Northfield Bank.
I haven't got an account in.
It's one of the many, Mr. Taylor. It's the scene of the robbery in Northfield, Minnesota, at which Jesse James officiated. Does that come back to you now, Mr. Adams? Famous Northfield robbery. And how about Tellson's Bank? Tellson's Bank. Mr. Kieran.
Mr. Jarvis Lorry in Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
That's quite right. Exactly right. Or Jerry Cruncher, his man, both associated with Tellson's Bank. The Brooklyn Trust Company. Brooklyn Trust Company. Does that bring anything to your mind, Mr. Kieran?
Yes, sir. Held the mortgage on the Dodger Ball Club for quite a while.
Yes. Trusting and soft Brooklynites. Well, that was the bank from which Larry McPhail borrowed very heavily to finance the Dodgers, and turned out all right, didn't it?
Paid him back, yes,
every dollar. How about this one from Ralph Lowy in New York City? In what play is a marriage saved because of the following way? In what play is a marriage saved because the wife's maternal feeling causes her to choose the weaker of the two men? Mr. Wilcott.
Candida,
yes. George Bernard Shaw's Candida. Now, how about this one? The wife decides to fight like a tigress, says here like a tigress. I don't know why they always fight like a tigress for their husbands. The wife decides to fight for her husband in what play?
Any other play.
In many plays, I should think.
Only in the play.
But I...
There's a particular one I have in mind, gentlemen. It's Claire Booth's The Women, in which I think the action turns on a wife deciding to
was
fight.
Was that what Margalo Gilmore was doing?
I don't know whether it was Margalo Gilmore who did the fighting. I've forgotten how the cast worked out. Do you remember, Mr. Wilcott?
It's a great surprise to me.
I'm sorry, that's what it says here. The husband loses interest in the other woman because the wife arranges to have them see a good deal of each other.
Oh,
by the way, that's a fallacy. But in this play, it works out. The marriage is saved that way. Do you remember, any of you?
Sounds like Bernard Shaw.
No, it isn't, Mr. Kieran. It's Barry's What Every Woman Knows. Barry's What Every Woman Knows. Now, how about this one? The wife decides to give up her phony ideas of reform and be a real wife and mother.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Kieran?
Well, one I'll take would be Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah, are there ideas of reform?
No, it's a play by Rachel Crothers.
Yes, I should think that would be the answer. What one? Mr.
Susan and Gardner.
Susan and Gardner, Mr. Wilcott. And Mr. Taylor, thank you. Well, that, I think, loses a $50 percent bond to Mr. Ralph Lowy of the city, and a set of the Britannica goes with it, of course. The next one comes from C.L. Jones of East Orange, New Jersey. Now, gentlemen, you're going to listen to three different conversations. In connection with what field of activity would each of these conversations be overheard? In other words, each of them uses a special kind of language. Let's have the first.
Hey, Hoople, how's the clock in that stone crusher of yours?
It's the icebreaker. See you on the show break.
What are these gentlemen talking about? Any guesses? Does it mean anything to you at all, Mr. Kieran?
Might be a racing.
No, it's not.
See you on the show break.
See you on the show break. Doesn't that recall anything?
When that circus?
No, no. Two taxi drivers. The translation is very simple. A hoople is a driver on a 24-hour stretch, and he says, what's the meter reading on that cab with a knocking motor, that stone crusher of yours? The other says, nothing. This is my first fare of the day, the icebreaker. See you on the show break. I'll see you when the theater's let out. It's as simple as ABC, isn't it, Mr. Wilcox?
Yeah.
Sure, nothing could be easier. We'll just mark that wrong. Now let's have a second.
That blind Tom ought to have a tin cup. He ain't giving us a corner all day.
Yeah, and what's more, old Moses has been giving him this and that right along.
Kieran.
That's easy. A couple of ball players talking about a fine, upstanding, honest, efficient umpire.
I've never heard you talk that way about umpires, Mr. Kieran. Not generally as warm as that. Yeah. What's the general idea of the conversation, Mr. Kieran?
Why, they're complaining that the umpire isn't calling the strikes that nick the corner of the plate.
Yeah. Not getting any breaks at all. And how about this one? The third and last is the hardest, I think.
This mark is a Canadian. Remember, all you sticks are Morgans and Whitneys. So act your part, and your end will be good for at least a C note.
Supposing he sings?
He wouldn't sing. The girls are looking for him back home.
Mr. Wilcott?
Well, I think it's criminal.
Oh, highly. Yeah. And what particular kind?
The holdup.
Not now, precisely, Mr. Adams.
It's counterfeiting.
Well, it might be counterfeiting. What makes you think that? What makes you think it's counterfeiting?
I think it's confidence.
Yes, it's a con game, Mr.
Because
Taylor.
The sticks would be yokels, and the Morgans and Whitneys, they're posing as...
No, the sticks are not yokels. The sticks are also confidence men. Confidence men are setting a game for a dupe. The dupe is a Canadian, and the Confederates, who are sticks, are to pretend they're wealthy themselves, Morgans and Whitneys, and their reward will be $100 apiece. What does suppose he sings mean? Mr. Kieran?
Well, that's easy. That means turn state's evidence.
Yes, go to the district attorney. And the other fellow says he wouldn't because the gulls are looking for him back home. The police are looking for him back in Canada. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. And so far, that means Lucky Strike has paid out $250 defense bonds and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And now here's Mr. Cross, who, like Mr. Kieran, is given to supporting his statements with real authority.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you've noticed that when we say Lucky Strike means fine tobacco, we don't just let it go at that. We bring you actual market reports which prove that the makers of Lucky's consistently pay the price to get the milder, better tasting tobacco. For example, here's a report that's typical. At auctions in South Boston, Virginia this season, the American Tobacco Company paid 29% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 29% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. Yes, smokers, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. That's a fact worth remembering and worth acting on, because you know, if you stop to think of it, that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. Mr. Fadiman, have I shown reason enough for making the next package Lucky's?
Mr. Cross, you've given us both facts and figures in just 57 seconds. Mr. Wilcott, coming up in the cab tonight, you were telling me that when you're over in England, you're on an information please, too. Is it any different from the way in which we run our little game here?
Oh, it's much pleasanter, yeah.
It's much pleasanter over there? You mean the questions are easier?
Well, we first get lunch. And then you don't have to know anything to answer the question.
Well, are the questions similar to the ones we ask?
Oh, no, they don't ask questions of fact. They ask questions of opinion. The first question I asked me was, Julian Huxley was on, and Enid Bagnold, and Professor Joad, and the first question was, what do you think of the future of the horse? And the next question was, what did I think of the influence of parents on children?
Did they ask that of you, Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
And I suppose you have a very sound...
You mean a half-hour program?
Mr. Kieran, how would you like to be on a program like that?
It'd be too difficult for me.
It'd be very difficult. We're used to exact facts. We have no opinions about anything up here, Mr. Wilcott, you see?
You depress me.
Oh, I see what you can do with it. Maybe I can depress you even further with a question from Carrie M. Burlingham of Denver. Name a child of literature or the theater who lived on a farm. A child, Mr. Wilcott.
Rebecca.
Rebecca, yes.
Of Sunnybrook Farm, yeah, by Kate Douglas Wiggins.
Yes, we want to get our Rebecca straight. It's not the other Rebecca. Who is the other Rebecca?
West.
No, I don't mean that one at all. Du Maurier's Rebecca.
Oh, you mean Daphne Du
Maurier? Daphne Du Maurier.
Oh, I wouldn't discuss it.
Didn't live on a farm. How about a child who lived in a workhouse? Oh, workers, as I imagine they call it over in England, Mr.
Oliver Twist.
Oliver Twist, quite right. And one who lived in an Indian army camp. Mr. Wilcott.
Lee Willie Winchie.
Yes, 3 out of 3, Mr. Wilcott. 3 out of 3, very good. Do you like this better than you like the English program now?
I like to talk about a horse.
Give us a chance. We might get the horse before the evening is over. Here's one from Miss Clara Deasy of Cincinnati. Mr. Kahn, our studio pianist, is going to play 3 compositions. Now, each of these is written in imitation of the style of another. Mr. Wilcott, come back to your microphone. You have to answer these questions, too. I want you to identify the composition and the composer who is being imitated or who is suggested by the composition that you're going to hear played. Am I thoroughly unclear?
Suppose it's a bad imitation.
Even so.
Even so. You have to name it.
All right. Let's have the first. Get 2 out of 3. Mr. Taylor had his hand up once.
Chopin.
Is being imitated.
Yes.
Who's doing the imitation?
Who's doing the imitation?
Mm-hmm.
The pianist.
Ah. yes, and a very good one, shall we say. But who is the composer of the piece that's being played?
Oh, I was so eager to get out Chopin, I didn't let the...
You're quite right. Now, do you want to hear a few more bars of it?
I'd love to.
All right. Mr. Kahn, would you give us a few more bars? Mr. Taylor has given us the right answer. Chopin is the one who is being imitated, and Schumann is the author of the imitation.
Believe it or not, I was going to say Schumann.
Well, believe it or not, I was going to say Schumann. I leave it to the audience. Now the second one. Mr. Wilcott had his hand.
Old Porter imitating the old count.
Very good, yes. It's. Do you recognize what it comes from?
I ought to know.
Mr. Wilcott's heard that once or twice in his life. It's from The Man Who Came to Dinner, of course, yes. And how do you you think the imitation's as good as the original, Mr. Wilcott?
Well, I think it's a pastiche.
I beg your pardon. Good.
Baby.
We never had that word on this show before. That's a pastiche.
It's a kind of crayon, isn't it?
That's very good. And now the third imitation. Come back to you, Mr. Adams?
I don't know. It seems to me that Bach is being imitated.
Very good, Mr. Adams. That's quite right.
Isn't it by the author of the music goes round and round?
Oh, no. I hope Mr. Templeton doesn't hear you say that.
Alec Templeton is the author of it. It's Bach Goes to Town. And the Innocent Imitation. It's a variation on a Bach fugue. And do you feel pretty proud of
now,
yourself?
Now, wait a minute.
The
protest here.
All right, go ahead.
The ground rules. You mean that Alec Templeton is imitating Bach?
Sure, he's taking the Bach
fugue. Alec Templeton is not a well-known composer. He's a pianist and a beautiful one.
Yes, but he does...
Yes, but these others were composers imitating other composers.
Well, if he composed this piece, he's a composer, isn't
not
he?
If I don't recognize his style, he's not a composer.
Oh. That's a funny standard set up. I think you're just sore because Mr. Adams got the right answer.
Certainly.
Oh, right.
That gives us 3 out of 3 on that.
But Wolcott could imitate Adams. I mean, could imitate Adams, for instance.
Wolcott could?
Yes.
Again?
Gentlemen, back to business. Here's one from Mrs. Victor L. Sherman of Glen Ellen, Illinois. In what book or movie do these sporting events occur at important points in the story? The first is a race between fishing schooners. In what book or movie, in this case, both, does that occur, Mr. Adams?
Captain's Courageous.
Captain's Courageous, yes. Now, how about a cricket match? Where do you find a cricket match appearing, Mr. Kieran?
Find a cricket match in Pickwick Papers.
You sure do?
Oh, yes.
Yes, it doesn't appear an important point in the story. It
every point is important in Pickwick Papers.
That's very patriotic.
Compound of rugby.
There probably is a cricket
match.
That's
a football game.
Hope they play cricket.
I think the one that most of us would think of, however, is Goodbye, Mr. Chips. No, Mr. Wilcott, isn't there a cricket match in Goodbye, Mr. Chips?
I don't recall, not particularly. I do recall it from Pickwick, but I don't
recall. I recall it from Pickwick. I've never read Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
You haven't?
Mm. No. Any good?
You haven't read Gone with the Wind either, but you've been taking cracks at it.
Well, that's why. Much easier to make cracks on books you haven't read, Mr. Wilcott. How about field hockey? Field hockey, in what novel? Oh, perhaps 20 years or so ago? Do you find field hockey appearing at an important point in the story? Mr. Britling sees it through. As the war begins, Mr. Britling is playing field hockey. Well, I think I'll have to call that wrong. The answer I really want was Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and send a $50 chance bomb to Mr. Sherman, plus a Britannica. How about this one from Bill Ritter of Detroit? Why are these names important in the history of newspapers? The first name is Matthew Brady. In the history of journalism, Mr. Wilcott.
He's the photographer of the Civil War.
Yes, the first news photographer, we might say. He photographed the Civil War. How about Lord Northcliffe? And Mr. Adams.
I think he issued the first tabloid of the time.
Yes, the first illustrated tabloid. What was it called, do you remember? The Daily Mirror. And how far back did that go? We tend to think of the tabloid as a relatively modern invention. Mr. Kieran?
Oh, well, it was in England in the war, before the war.
Oh, long before.
Yes.
Long before the first.
Yeah, before the first war.
The Daily Mirror was in New York, in London, as long ago as 1908 and probably before.
Just before, but about 1903. So you see, it has a long heritage.
Well, how about the man who said that he'd founded one of his papers for people who couldn't think and the Daily Mirror for people who couldn't read?
That might have been he. It sounds very much like Northcliffe. How about R.C. Outcault? Why is Mr. Wilcott?
Well, the first comic strip.
Yes, the first comic strip.
Oh, The Yellow Kid.
Was it Hogan's Alley or The Yellow...
Yellow Kid.
The Yellow Kid.
The Yellow Kid. When? About?
93.
Well, in the 90s. In the 90s, sure. So that goes back a long way, too. Now, how about this one from Edith Kingsley of Cheshire, Connecticut? These are the authors of some great American classics. What are the classics? The first author is Timothy Shea Arthur. What classic did he write? Timothy Shea Arthur, Mr. Adams.
T.S. Arthur, he was known as, and the classic, Eludes Me.
I
can't answer those, I'm there.
Well, I'll tell you, he can make more out of an answer like that than most people can.
You can wind up for a strikeout.
You know it as well as you do the nose on your face, which is going some, Mr. Adams. 10 Nights in a Barroom. 10 Nights in a Barroom. How about Ernest Lawrence Thayer? What did he write? Mr. Kieran?
Casey at the Bat.
Yes, what were you going to say, Mr. Adams?
Casey at the Bat.
Okay. And Gilbert Patton, Mr. Adams.
Gilbert Patton was Bert L. Standish. He wrote under Bert L. Standish and wrote Nick Carter.
I don't think he wrote Nick Carter.
Frank Merriwell.
Frank Merriwell. The famous Frank Merriwell stories. That gives us 2 out of 3. Now, how about this one from Ensign William W. White of Minneapolis? I'm going to give you the given names of some famous people who all happen to have the same last name. I want you to give me the last name. For example, Edgar, Henry, and Lou would all have as the last name what?
Hoover.
No, Adams. Wallace. Edgar Wallace, Henry Wallace, and Lou Wallace. Is that all clear, Mr. Adams? Now, how about this? Charles Phelps and Robert Alfonso have the same last name, Mr. Adams.
Taft.
Yes, they're the sons of William Howard Taft. Stephen Vincent and William Rose, Mr. Taylor.
Benet.
Yes. And Horatio, Donald, and Byron all have the last same last name. Horatio, comma, Donald, comma, and Byron.
This is Alger.
No. Donald Alger and Byron Alger?
I think so.
And, oh, gentlemen, you should get this one. It's a name that's been in the public prints recently, and it's
Nelson. Nelson.
Yes, of course, Mr. Adams. I don't think I'm going to give you credit for it.
No, I don't know.
I don't think so. However, we got 2 out of 3 on that. Horatio Nelson, Donald M. Nelson, of course, and Byron Nelson, who, Mr. Kieran, is...
Champion golfer.
Is a champion golfer. That didn't come to your mind as I read these three names.
No, I was thinking of Byron.
You mean George Gordon?
That's right.
Noel, Lord Byron. No, that's the wrong one. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. And now here's Mr. Cross, who says he wishes you'd go down south and talk to a few independent tobacco experts in person.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I know you'd be impressed by the genuine enthusiasm of these experts for fine tobacco. They're constantly talking about its ripeness, mellowness, body, and texture. For make no mistake, they know as you do, if you stop to think of it, that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And the qualities experts look for in buying, selling, and handling the leaf are the very qualities that give you mildness and better taste. Now, these experts know that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco, because at market after market, they see us pay the price to get the better quality leaf. For example, this season at auctions in Kinston, North Carolina, the American Tobacco Company paid 25% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Mullins, South Carolina, 34% more, and so on all over the South. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Why not make your next package Lucky Strike and see if you don't confirm their judgment?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out 3 $50 defense bonds, and that means 3 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Taylor, for joining Lucky Strike's party tonight. And thank you, Mr. Wilcott. Mr. Wilcott, if you ever get back to England and go on that information, please show again. Give our English cousins our best, will you?
All right. Such as a kid.
next week, Oscar Levant, John Kieran, and Franklin P. Adams will be on deck, and our guest will be Janet Flanner, journalist, author of An American in Paris, and member of the staff of the New Yorker magazine. Remember, listeners, for every question that's answered correctly, the sender gets $10 in defense stamps, and for every question that stumps our board, you get a total of a $50 defense bond, and in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
When you hear that chant, ladies and gentlemen, remember these 2 important facts. That at market after market, we pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting tobaccos. And that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Yes, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. But see for yourself. Next time, ask for Lucky Strike.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.